This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Today on The World, what makes any meal, no matter how modest, something special?
If you, in your life, had something cooked by someone in your family that put love in the food, you feel something, it's a sensation.
We're celebrating Thanksgiving today with food stories from around the world. On the menu, wine, and therefore cheese.
Vaughan cheese is traditionally made with raw sheep's milk, flecked with wild herbs that are grown in the mountains and fed by the snowmelt.
You'll also need to pick a protein. Cicadas, anyone?
A lot of people think that, oh, insects are all crunchy and stuff, but these are actually really juicy.
And food writer Nick Sharma on the staying power of taste.
What was once not a tradition then becomes a tradition after it's repeated again and again.
A la table for this Thanksgiving Day edition of The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Happy Thursday, happy Thanksgiving, however you may be celebrating. As for us, we are marking the holiday with a special program that is all about, what else, food, and how cooking and eating food connect us to cultures and places all over the globe. At the center of the holiday, family. That is true for the modest home cooks among us and for the world's most renowned chefs. I'm thinking of Eric Ripert, the chef of the famed New York restaurant Le Bernardin. Ripert spoke with me on the show a few years back about the influences that shaped his approach to food. It all started with his parents' divorce.
I think my mother was giving back some love to her son, which is me, through the cooking that she was doing for us. She was trying to bring back the family together. Mm. I had a very tense relationship with my stepfather, and she was making sure that we would sit for breakfast, lunch, and dinner and have a very special experience. And it's when we made peace at the table.
Now, Chef Ripert practices Buddhism, and he spent considerable time studying food that is prepared in Buddhist temples, specifically in South Korea. He described to me what he called the philosophy of temple food.
And the philosophy is very simple. Temple food is based on a vegan diet.
It's about just having a very clean, simple palate, it seems.
Very clean, simple palate, but also it's much more complex than that. The experience of cooking for them is a practice. It's a mindfulness exercise, like a meditation. When they cultivate the plants, they make sure that they put love and compassion in the process. They pray for the food to be beneficial to the people who are going to eat it. And then when they go to the kitchen, all the food that they give to the monks, nuns, or the guests has some medicinal virtues. For instance, end of the summer, they expose food a lot to the energy of the sun. So during the winter, they don't have the cold, they don't have a lot of sickness that we have in the West. Mm. And it seems to be working. I went there for personal reasons, not necessarily to transform Le Bernardin, which is a seafood restaurant, into a vegan restaurant. The idea was to learn fermentation, aging food, and it was a spiritual experience.
How has this experience affected your career?
Of course, I have been inspired by many of the flavors and techniques that I saw in Korea. Now, I am not necessarily teaching the cooks how to put love and compassion in a Buddhist kind of way. I'm not trying to convert the cooks. I'm trying to find a secular way to teach them to respect the products, especially because we serve animals that were alive and feel suffering and so on. And it's a sacrifice of their life. So therefore, I want to make sure that we have that kind of respect.
What do you think U.S. chefs, what can they learn from the spiritual experience you had?
If you just cook without passion, without love, without being in a present, I don't believe that you will cook better. In Korea, I met a nun, and she claimed that she could discover who cooked the food. And she would say, for instance, this dish has been cooked by this person. I feel the energy. And she could know also if the person is stressed or the person is happy. We had some food and she mentioned to me that the food was cooked by someone who was having a problem. And I was not believing that necessarily. And she brought one of the cook and it was true. The person was having some problems and she could feel it into the food. Now, most of us do not feel that, obviously, but I can guarantee you one thing. If you in your life had something cooked by someone that put love in the food, you feel something. It's a sensation. And I think a lot of people have the same experience. They can make the difference in between something that has been cooked by someone who loves to cook and industrial food. It explains why you can feel the love in the food.
The love in the food. That's French chef Eric Ripert, the famed New York restaurant Le Bernardin, speaking with me a few years back about the influence Buddhism has had on his cooking. His new book out this year is called Vegetable Simple, A Cookbook. Wine, of course, an important part of any French meal. The fall grape harvest in France was significantly smaller than usual this year. Extreme weather events cost the wine industry a third of its crop. In the legendary Bordeaux region, there are winemakers and scientists experimenting with new ways to make French wine more resilient to a changing climate. From Bordeaux, reporter Rebecca Rossman has that story.
Jonathan Ducour is a fourth-generation wine grower with an 1,100-acre property located just outside Bordeaux.
You want
to
go on the top?
Sure. He invites me on top of a grape harvesting machine.
And it collects the grapes, mostly the berries, little by little.
As we snake through the rows of vines, the machine shakes the fruit and scoops it up. In a normal year, Ducour says his family produces around 3 million bottles of wine. But this year...
For the whites, we almost finished the harvest, so we know we lost about 50%.
And he expects a 30% loss of red wine grapes. That's because of a warm early spring and a severe late frost that killed many of his grapes. Experts say those conditions were made more likely by climate change, and they were followed by heavy rains, which fueled mildew.
This little grape was attacked by a mushroom and...
It's all dried up.
Yeah.
The number of unexpected weather events have only increased for the Ducour family over the last 10 years. He says they even took out a special climate change insurance for winemakers. But they're working on a longer-term solution. He takes me to another corner of the vineyard and shows off his experimental vines.
We harvested this block last week.
Most of the vineyard has pure vines, growing only one type of grape. That's the standard in France. The six we're looking at right now have different grape varieties grafted onto each vine. These varieties were specially selected because they're more resistant to things like drought and late frost.
So this one is called Sauvignac, and it's a hybrid of Sauvignon Blanc, Riesling, and wild vines.
Okay, we're tasting the grape here. This is the hybrid. Oh, it's a good grape.
But these hybrid vines are also controversial. In France, where tradition is king, wine can only be labeled Bordeaux if it's made with any six kinds of traditional grape varieties. Ducour says he respects this tradition, but...
At the same time, we also need to be ready for what's next.
Hybrid wines have already been widely embraced in Germany and Switzerland, and some hybrid varieties have been approved for use in certain table wines in France.
So, in between the wooden posts here, there's five vines in each row.
At an experimental vineyard on the outskirts of Bordeaux, Marc Gaudy shows students some of the more than 50 grape varieties he's been studying at the Institute of Sciences for Vine and Wines. Gaudy, who moved here from California, says getting tradition-bound French winemakers on board with these experimental vines has been a bit of an uphill battle. Whereas in the U.S.
I can plant whatever I want, from wherever I want, whenever I want. It's literally the Wild West, right?
Some of the most successful varieties in the experimental vineyard come from southern European countries with a slightly warmer climate, including Spain, Portugal, and Italy. But testing new varieties isn't the only solution for wine growers, Gaudi says. Special pruning techniques are being tested to protect the vines.
For instance, right here, this is a style of pruning where you have a big bushy vine and you're potentially providing protection for the fruit from sun and heat.
Gaudi also says letting winemakers irrigate their crops, something that's been banned in France, could make a difference. But even where traditional techniques and grapes are still being used, French wine is still changing with a changing climate. Nathalie Ola is head researcher at the Experimental Vineyard.
The wine is with a higher alcohol content and a lower acidity, and it affects the balance of the wine and also its ability to last and to be preserved.
For now, Ola says these changes are only doing good things to the taste of wine. She says this will change for the worse in about a generation. And if practices stay as they are, that will likely mean sour grapes. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Bordeaux.
Wine is not everyone's cup of tea. It's also not the only drink that is earning the attention of refined palates. A small group of professionals is out to show you that water has taste. Yeah, water. Okay, I'll bite, or sip, rather. The World's Bianca Hillier introduces us to some of the globe's very few water sommeliers.
Christina Lee is the first and only water sommelier in Canada. And she's used to the look of surprise when she tells people what she does for a living.
Usually they would say, what? What are you talking about, water sommelier?
Simply put, a water sommelier is just the water version of a wine sommelier. Someone who's an expert in the taste and characteristics of wine. There are at least 100 water sommeliers around the world, and they've all gone through official training to know what makes one water different from the next. So I asked Lee to guide me through a virtual tasting to explain all of this in detail.
We'll do a flight of the still water first, okay?
First up is a water called Penta, which has gone through a lengthy 13-step purification process.
So what do you think?
It tastes like water.
It tastes like water.
Nothing to write home about. At this point, I'm not sure I'll be able to pick up on the variations. Then I took a sip of a different water called Starkey.
All right, take a sip.
Yeah.
Oh, that is completely different.
Do you feel that you're finally eating fresh vegetables instead of like processed frozen vegetables,
yes,
in a sense?
Yes. If I were to drink water from a stream... This tastes like what I might expect.
Exactly.
Turns out that water actually is from a geothermal spring. It hasn't been filtered as much as the first water, so it still contains all of its minerals and therefore tastes so different. Lee walked me through 5 still and 3 sparkling waters. Some were kind of salty. Another left my mouth feeling dry. Basically, most of the differences in taste are because of where the water is from and what minerals it contains. Calcium, potassium, magnesium, and silica all lead to different tastes. Candace Jansen is a water sommelier in Johannesburg, South Africa. She helps restaurants create water menus and food pairings. For example, water with a low mineral content and subtle taste, like Fiji water, would pair with
something like a sushi, a light salad, something that's not substantial in taste, not vibrant, not spicy, not salty, just kind of soft.
But if you're eating a steak, Jansen would pour you something totally different, like Vichy Catalan, which is kind of the champagne of sparkling water.
It's got a high sodium content, big bubbles. It really just brings that saltiness out of your meal.
But for many water sommeliers, including Jansen and Christina Lee, the job is about much more than taste. Water sommeliers are also water advocates. They work to increase access to clean water, teach people how to reduce waste, from plastic bottles to water that often just goes down the drain. And overall, they urge others to give water the attention it deserves. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
We continue our holiday-inspired dive into the global culture of food and drink just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World on this Thanksgiving Thursday. And on our global food tour, stories about things we eat and drink. In eastern Turkey, in the city of Van, there is a market devoted entirely to cheese. And not just any cheese. This is a regional specialty made from sheep's milk and wild herbs gathered in the mountains. As Duri Buscarin reports from the cheese market, the makers of Van cheese say they struggle to keep their traditions going when faced with competition from the big cheeses, the industrial producers.
When this cheese producer gets up in the morning, in the village where his family cares for hundreds of sheep, he puts on a checkered sports coat and a flat cap, and he drives into the city with kilos and kilos of white, salty cheese.
Well done.
He says, since I know myself, I do this cheese.
His name is Islam Soydoğan, and he's 63 years old. Through a translator, he explains how Van cheese is traditionally made with raw sheep's milk, flecked with wild herbs that are grown in the mountains and fed by the snowmelt, garlic, mountain thyme, sometimes even wildflowers. They're heated up in a big pot with enzymes.
And then we put under the ground for minimum six months to stay under the ground. And then you can take out and then you can eat it.
The taste is salty, reminiscent of feta, but with something deeper, earthier. Suddenly, I'm looking for crackers, maybe a beer. The translator, Angel Istekalcu, likes it too.
Nom, nom, nom. I like it.
It's good?
This is kind of breakfast in summer. Cheese and watermelon. This cheese and watermelon, it's great.
Van is a city that's Turkish by law and Kurdish by culture. Centuries ago, it was the center of an Armenian kingdom. In this cheese market, almost every shop is devoted to Van's regional specialty. There are soft Van cheeses, hard Van cheese, one that's aged underground and another that's crumbly and meant to be mixed with yogurt. There are plastic tubs of pickled herbs to serve with your cheese. And it's not just residents of Van who are crazy about this cheese. In the shop behind us, big plastic containers are being packed and sealed, ready to be shipped all over the country. The way real Van cheese is made hasn't changed in generations, in a village by someone who takes care of their own sheep. But that way of life is slowly fading away, explains Hassan Kayhan, and real Van cheese isn't always real. The Americans taught us how to cheat, he tells me. In the 1930s, he says, U.S. companies started exporting powdered milk to Turkey, so much so that people in Kayhan's village called it American powder. Now, milk powder is used by less scrupulous cheese producers to keep costs down. The cost of feeding sheep through the winter, he says, has tripled. Kayhan serves as a spokesperson for the bazaar and says his family has run this shop for three generations. He worries that the producers he relies on won't stay in the business much longer. He claims that in 10 years, half of Van cheese made in Turkey will be produced in a factory. But at least for the moment, there seems to be a healthy demand. One woman in a long dress and headscarf says she's buying 75 pounds of the stuff.
I said, what do you do with this? She said, we are actually like tribal. We love guests, so people are coming and going, that's why we buy.
She says she'll freeze half to keep her through the winter, when the sheep aren't giving milk and the cheese doesn't have that same real taste. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin in the Van Cheese Market.
From South America through the U.S. and Canada, we've shared many stories of migration with you. As migration increases, so do the accounts of people helping each other out along the route. On the border of Mexico and Guatemala, there is one woman who's making it her personal mission to help migrants by feeding them good meals. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia brought us her story.
Estrella López is browning red onion slices in a large pot over the wood-fired stove in her kitchen. She slices 6 pounds of tomatoes. She cracks 90 eggs into bowls. She pours everything into the pot and sprinkles in some chicken soup seasoning along with red meat seasoning. Estrella's one-year-old son is trying to get the attention of her husband. It's 6 a.m. and the family has already been awake for hours. Estrella and her husband carry the eggs, a pot of black beans, and a large pot of black coffee down the hill from their house. And they serve it on styrofoam plates and cups to people staying at a shelter.
Sí, lo hacemos con todo nuestro corazón.
We're doing this from the heart, Lopez says. Lopez has been rising early to make breakfast every day for the past month. That's how long human rights organizations say Mexican authorities have been dumping busloads of Central American migrants here in the town of El Cebo, a small dot on the Mexico-Guatemala line. Lopez and her husband sometimes pay for the groceries themselves. Others, they get help from a local health nonprofit. I feel very grateful for people who feed us, says Ezequiel Tercero, an electrician from Nicaragua who was hoping to reach the U.S. Migrants often receive the opposite of help. Mexican immigration agents were recorded in southern Mexico this weekend throwing a migrant to the ground and kicking him in the face. Authorities suspended two agents. But most of the two dozen people I interviewed in El Cebo said they were extorted by authorities in Mexico or Guatemala. Tercero says that once people don't have any money, they walk for days without eating. He says he went 4 days getting by on what he'd find growing on trees along the way, like nance fruit, avocados, or guavas. And he says that when someone does give him a hot meal, it's difficult to enjoy it.
Mi situación es trabajar.
Why, Tercero asks? He says it's because he wants to be working and paying for his own food and sending money to his family. Antonio Portillo says he migrated from Honduras before he was pushed back by U.S. Border Patrol agents near McAllen, Texas.
Sí, claro. Pasé hambre. Pasé hambre.
Portillo says that, of course, he went hungry for days, too. And he says the people who helped him along the way were people as poor as he is.
Es que sabe cuál es el problema.
Portillo says that poor people understand another poor man's problems, so if they can give someone a plate of food, they do. Estrella Lopez has indeed gone through the same experience as the people she's feeding every morning.
Sí, una vez también lo intenté yo.
Lopez says she tried migrating to the U.S. once, about 15 years ago. She says she was a teenager and her family was desperately poor, so she wanted to move to Maryland, where she had a friend and hoped to find work.
Aguanté como 3 días. Aguanté.
Lopez says at one point she went 3 days without food. She was walking and catching bus rides through Mexico until she was caught near Mexico City and deported. She's now a community health worker here in El Cebo, still making a very modest living. And she says seeing people go through town reminds her of her most difficult days.
Cada vez que hago esto, me siento feliz, me siento contenta, ¿me entiendes?
Every time I make these breakfasts, Lopez says, I feel happy. She says it brings her joy to know that when people get back on their way, they're leaving with sustenance in their stomach. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia, El Cebo, Guatemala.
More Thanksgiving Day stories from around the globe are still ahead in the next half of the show. You're listening to The World. Cooking, especially on the holidays, can often focus our thoughts on one person.
I credit my mom for the best qualities that I have, and for any ones that may not be as good, I blame myself for not listening to her, really.
Good son. Chef Joseph Yoon waxes nostalgic and sautés cicadas. You heard me right. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's a Thanksgiving Day special devoted to food. In the global fight against illegal drugs, Thailand has long been a top U.S. ally in Asia, a country where illegal drug possession can lead to long prison sentences. But attitudes are changing in Thailand. Officials there are following the same path of many U.S. states and slowly rolling back some of their tough laws on cannabis. So how did this story make the cut for our Thanksgiving special on food and global cooking? The World's Patrick Nguyen traveled a few hours outside Bangkok and found that weed is part of a new trend in Thai cuisine.
A sizzling wok inside a restaurant called Ban Lao Rung. The head cook, Amara Akamanon, is adding garlic and chilies. Soon she will add pork, but one ingredient she will not add is MSG. With pride, she tells me, I've got something better than MSG.
Mm-hmm.
Ganja, she says, the official Thai word for cannabis. She sprinkles it over all of her dishes. I put ganja leaves in soups, curries, stir fries, she says. My customers say it makes everything taste better. Amara's restaurant is set in a cozy house in a rural province, 2 hours outside of Bangkok. And it's about as far from a stoner hangout as you could imagine. I see grandmas eating spoonfuls of curry and uncles slurping down tom yum, an herbal soup. All of it spiked with ganja. But are people here getting zonked? Maybe a little, Amara says. Eat my food, your mood may lift. Maybe you'll get a case of the giggles. Or, lots of people feel nothing at all, she says. That's because she only adds cannabis leaves, which have just a touch of THC, the chemical that gets you high. Most THC is in the cannabis flower or bud. But Amara and other cooks are realizing the leaves act as a taste enhancer, adding a kick of umami, the savory fifth flavor after salty, sweet, bitter, and sour. Umami is that mouth-watering sensation that is also amplified by monosodium glutamate, MSG. Getting buzzed is nice, she says, but what ganja is really good for is summoning that umami flavor. Umami is that eyes-rolling back goodness you get from foods like bacon, Parmesan cheese, garlicky marinara sauce. All those things have a lot of natural glutamic acid, the source of that umami magic. But ganja leaves have even more glutamic acid. And don't take it from me. Here's a doctor from Thailand's top herbal medicine center, Chao Phraya Apaibubet. That's Dr. Walilat Klaisakon, who goes by Cherry. She says ganja leaves are probably better for you than MSG. And whether MSG is actually bad for you is debated, but Dr. Cherry says, for sure, cannabis has health benefits. Ganja leaves are antioxidants, she says. They have anti-inflammatory properties too. Dr. Cherry is part of a shift in how Thai society sees cannabis. As of last year, cannabis oil with THC can be legally prescribed by Thai doctors for anything from chemotherapy relief to just sleeplessness. Smoking cannabis buds is still illegal for now, but herbal experts like Dr. Cherry have told the Thai government, don't make the whole plant illegal. There are all these uses for ganja outside the bud, she says, like in cuisine. Thai culture is all about cuisine, she says, the beauty of food, the flavors. And as of 2021, the government is saying, okay, certain eateries can now legally cook with ganja leaves. Which brings us back to Chef Amara, whose little kitchen is on the vanguard of this umami cannabis experiment. That's her wooden mortar and pestle, grinding chilies, and fresh ganja leaves for a pork rib stew. I've had it. It is an umami explosion. Chef Amara is in her early 60s. She's a former nurse, very warm and polite, and is as surprised as anyone to be a pioneer at the bleeding edge of drug reform. So I have to ask the chef, back in the day, did you ever try smoking ganja? No way, she says. I was always a proper lady. Obviously, she still is, and that just shows how much attitudes are changing here in Thailand. The DEA and Thai cops used to hunt down cannabis smugglers with guns drawn. Now ganja is sprinkled over noodles and eaten by, well, proper ladies and gentlemen too. Chef Amara says this legal shift opens up a new way forward for doing business, for looking after your health, and she thinks it's about time. For the world, Patrick Nguyen, Prachinburi, Thailand.
Let me cast you back to a moment last summer when a certain Washington Post columnist got plenty of blowback for his ignorance of Indian cooking. He incorrectly dissed Indian food as, quote, based entirely on one spice, that being curry powder, an amalgam of various spices often dependent on the chef who's making the mix. The collective eye roll over that curry commentary gave us the opportunity to connect with food writer, cook, and photographer Nick Sharma. Sharma moved to the States from India in his early 20s. His books include Season and The Flavor Equation.
I mean, I don't have a problem saying the word curry, but I have never used curry powder myself.
So what are some of the spices Americans will have heard of that go into curries?
I guess turmeric is the first thing that comes to mind.
Turmeric, yeah.
Because most curries tend to be yellow in color, at least with the curry powder that they've been using. So I know turmeric is something that is the quickest thing. The second thing I think would be cumin, and the third spice would be coriander. I would think these three spices are probably what comes to mind when people say curry.
What do you bring into your own cooking to kind of vary the different kind of curries that you make?
So I actually don't use turmeric a lot. I just think it's one of those spices that needs to be used wisely, too much, and then things start to taste pungent. But in terms of spices, I do use cumin, I do use coriander, but I also use spices like nigella, fennel, fenugreek. There's just so many spices available, and I think it's a shame to kind of restrict one's repertoire just to like a blend.
So as you know, Thailand and Japan also have curries. Are any of the kind of spices that you use in India, do they transfer over to those countries, or is that a completely different story altogether?
No, absolutely they do, because, I mean, if you think about it, borders were something that were defined much recently, and before that, and even now, you know, the spices are still traded, and especially in Southeast Asia, where you do find a lot of these recipes that are called curries, you do have a lot of these spices that are similar or the same ones that are being used, but in different combinations and in different ways, which is what makes those dishes unique and special. So you'll see ginger and garlic, which is used in a lot of Southeast Asian cuisines to build flavor. You'll see cumin again. You'll see chilies, which is something that came from the New World to the Old World. And so you will see chilies play a significant part in these dishes.
Nick, what part of India are you from and how has that influenced your cooking?
I'm originally from Bombay on the west coast in India, but my dad's from the north of India, and then my mom's from Goa, which is on the west coast. And so my influences in cooking are very coastal because that's what I'm most familiar with. So coconut is one of the ingredients actually that plays a huge part in my cooking.
Do you keep those influences separate, or are you inclined to kind of merge them all together?
I do what comes most naturally to me, and that is to kind of avoid thinking of things as static elements. I think of them as much more fluid and they evolve as I evolve. So that's how my cooking is. For example, if turmeric is going to benefit the flavor in the dish, then I'll use it. If not, I'll stay away from it.
India, of course, is a huge country with a lot of diversity ethnically, linguistically, culturally. What part of India does the food in most Indian restaurants in the U.S. reflect?
Typically, it usually reflects the food that is cooked from the northern parts of the country, especially on the northwestern side, so from the states of Punjab. And then a lot of Indian food that has been popularized in the West has traditionally been food from the Mughal Empire. So the Mughal influences in India, who ruled India for a really long time, a lot of that food is quite popular in restaurants.
And as an Indian immigrant in the United States, how has that influenced your recipes in terms of ingredients you use or maybe just the impulse to experiment?
It definitely creates a room for me to talk about the food that I don't see on menus, and also the food that's not traditionally spoken about in mainstream media. So I take this as an opportunity to talk about the foods that I think people should know about. For example, I use a lot of tamarind in my cooking because, again, that's something that I grew up using in my food as a souring agent. And so you'll see a lot of my recipes that will use tamarind in different ways. So I try to bring a different perspective on Indian cooking to my work.
All right, final question. Chicken tikka masala. What did you know about this dish that seems to be in every Indian restaurant in the United States before you arrived in America?
I have eaten chicken tikka masala in India. It's not that I haven't. It's just not one of those dishes that I normally reach out to on the menu. Yeah, it's just not that special to me.
Why not? Everybody loves it, it seems. I mean, is it authentic at all in India?
I mean, I feel like authenticity is something that changes with time.
Mm.
You know, it's something that evolves. It's a dish that was created for a specific reason in restaurants and it's popular. So I wouldn't call it authentic, but I wouldn't also say it's not authentic because it's become a part of things over time. And I think one of the things we need to remember with food is that it evolves over time. What was once not a tradition then becomes a tradition after it's repeated again and again.
So what is your goal as a food writer and food creator living in the U.S., Nick?
My goal with food has always been to talk about the food that excites me and also to use this as a moment to teach people about new ingredients, new flavors, and hopefully, you know, this is something that they bring into their homes.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us about it. Nick Sharma, food writer, photographer, and cook. Thank you very much for being with us, Nick.
Thanks a lot.
There are a lot of ways to cook a turkey, but there are also a lot of ways to replace meat in your diet with other sources of protein. Remember Brood 10 last spring? The eruption of cicadas across the eastern U.S. inspired people to try insects. In many cuisines around the world, insects are a staple, but still very niche in the U.S. Joseph Yoon is a chef and founder of Brooklyn Bugs. He specializes in insect cuisine. When Brood 10 made its noisy arrival this year, Yoon got to work cooking cicadas.
These guys are just a delicacy. They're just full of fat and muscle tissue. So a lot of people think that, oh, insects are all crunchy and stuff, but these are actually really juicy with a very thin layer of exoskeleton. So it's really a delicacy.
Chef Yoon says cooking with cicadas isn't a novelty. He's really trying to find new ways to incorporate insect protein into people's diets. The environmental upsides are clear compared to raising livestock. Insects need far less food and water, and they produce a tiny fraction of what cattle, for example, emit as greenhouse gases. When it comes to cooking cicadas, Yoon shared a recipe with our colleague Bobby Bascom from the program Living on Earth.
I thought it would be really awesome to create a forbidden rice bowl with Brood X cicada nymphs.
Mm.
So we want to build a lot of flavor. And so what we have is half an onion, some carrots and garlic, asparagus, red peppers. And so these will be fried up along with the cicada nymphs and bring a ton of flavor to it. And this is some cricket ramp kimchi that I made. I have a chili pepper and also a Korean gochu pepper, perilla leaves, minari, and also some chrysanthemum.
Wow.
So with the forbidden rice, the beautiful thing about this sort of black rice is that it has a lot more nutrients and it has this like incredible nutty and fruity flavor to it and notes to it. It's just really so beautiful, the flavor that it packs in there.
Yeah, you can't go wrong there.
All right, I'm just going to start by cutting an onion here. I already chopped the asparagus and the carrots, and now I'm going to chop up some of these peppers. This is a Korean gochu pepper. Now that we have everything all chopped up, we're going to get our pan hot at about a medium high, and we're going to add some vegetable oil and then start adding a lot of the aromatics and start building some flavor.
All right, so what do you need to add first?
We're gonna start with some onions.
All right, sounds good.
Next, we're gonna add the carrots and garlic. You guys want all the peppers or only some of them?
Yeah, let's do all of them, why not?
All of them. So we're letting the onions caramelize a little bit. We're not getting caramelized onions, but we just want to get some caramelization and bring out the natural sugars. The carrots are also sweating down. The peppers are adding like this, like, the smell of it is just intoxicating for me. I just absolutely love it. So let me just mix it around. And let's go ahead and add the asparagus and red peppers.
All right.
Salt and pepper. All right, so let's go ahead and add the cicadas. I'm gonna create a little pocket here, add a little oil so we could get some good sizzle sound for the cicadas.
All right, in they go then.
So with the ramp kimchi, because it's like these long strands of ramp that I have here, I'm going to just cut them up into bite sizes so that they will work well. I'm just going to go ahead and use a scissor. It's a very Korean thing. There's no Korean mom that I know that does not use a pair of scissors in the kitchen. I'm not a Korean mom, don't tell me.
But you probably learned from a Korean mom.
I sure did, yeah. I credit my mom for the best qualities that I have, and for any ones that may not be as good, I blame myself for not listening to her, really. She's Aww. The best. Okay, so let's get ready to plate up What I'm going to do now, I'm going to just start layering the chrysanthemum greens on like a third of the bowl. I'm going to put the minati on like another third of the bowl and the perilla leaves on another third of the bowl. So I like the idea that we're also like hiding the forbidden rice and it's like lies underneath. And I'm going to surround this all with the cricket ramp kimchi. So I use cricket powder to thicken the kimchi paste instead of using a glutinous rice flour.
Nice.
And so it adds both flavor and serves a wonderful function. Let's give it a taste test and make sure this is up to snuff here.
Sounds great.
I'm going to get some of the greens. Looks like I got two cicadas in here, some of the veggies, some of the kimchi, a little bit of everything. Bon appetit, guys.
Mmm.
Mmm.
What's the verdict?
It's just so beautiful. Everything is so harmoniously balanced. It's a very special dish, and I'm so grateful to be able to share it with you guys.
That's Chef Joseph Yoon of Brooklyn Bug sharing his enthusiasm and inspiration for cooking with insects. In this case, cicadas. Hey, there were billions of them this year. Our thanks to Bobby Bascom and the PRX program Living on Earth for sharing that story with us. Please do not touch. The warning is posted in museums. If you don't obey, you can be sure you'll hear it. Maite Gomez-Rejon does not ascribe to that. She wants you to have a sensory experience when you visit a gallery. In fact, she wants you to taste it. Gomez-Rejon is a founder of Art Bites, where she teaches workshops on art, food, and history. Before the pandemic, that meant cooking classes inside museums. These days, she's hosting classes online, looking at art from across the globe for inspiration. Maite Gomez-Rejon spoke earlier this year with the world's Carol Hills.
Maite, I'd love to start with the way you pair food with art and history. It's not like you say, here's a still life painting of a pumpkin, so we're going to bake a pumpkin pie. I mean, you approach things in a more thematic and thoughtful way. Give us an example.
Yes, I like to look at a work of art. It could be a portrait, it could be a tapestry, it could be, you know, anything. And I think about the time period it was made in, the part of the world that it was made in, and then I delve into period cookbooks and sort of start reading between the lines of the recipes of the ingredients of the spices used. And that's where I come up with the recipes that we prepare inspired by the work of art to really look at the work of art in its context and really paint a picture of the time period when the art was made.
It sounds so interesting and of course, tasty. And I know one of your earliest projects was on Alexander the Great's travel. Give us an example there of what you cooked and what art you were looking at.
Alexander the Great traveled with commanders who kept a detailed record of everything, including everything that they were eating and all of the foods that they were encountering. So when they arrived in, you know, India, they were writing about sugar. They were calling it a sweet salt. They were writing about mangoes. When they were in Persia, they ate a dish of rice with sour cherries. So sort of telling these stories while looking at art from Southeast Asia from the 4th century BC or looking at reliefs from Persepolis. They had this meal right before they sort of sacked the entire palace. It just makes it real, you know, because oftentimes we go to a museum and we look at a work of art and it's very separate than us, you know, especially when we're looking at antiquities. It's hard to kind of make that connection. But when you bring in these real life stories and then make rice with sour cherries or make some sort of mango, you know, lassi or some sort of sweet mango dish, it's a way to time travel.
Hmm. In the case of the Alexander the Great travels, the class on that, did you at all try to recreate a recipe or were you using the types of food you were reading about and came up with recipes?
Definitely the type of foods that we were reading about, because there were really, back then, no recipes the way that we think about recipes today. So it was more writing about the herbs, writing about the spices. So I sort of take these stories and come up with a contemporary meal. I'm much more interested in the storytelling. I'm definitely based in the time period. I wouldn't include, say, you know, chocolate as much as I love it back in the 4th century BC in Iran because there wasn't any chocolate. I stay very close to what was available and what was being used. but the recipes are completely, you know, modern. Because I want people to make them. I want them to be delicious, and I want people to have a dinner party or just make them at home and have this association, you know, have a story to tell.
I'm curious whether in your classes, do you find that some of your students stare at works of art and look for food in it and say, can we eat some of that?
Sometimes, especially when we look at, like, you know, the Dutch still lives. I mean, they're so sensual. So there's definitely sometimes you just want to jump in there for sure.
You have an upcoming class on the 17th century Mexican nun, Juana Inez de la Cruz. Can you tell us about her and the dish you'll be preparing with the class?
She is fascinating. She's a nun that lived, you know, 17th century Mexico. She was a published poet in Spain. She was very famous. She had a whole library in her convent. And the earliest Mexican recipes are actually in her hand. She left about 33 recipes. Modern Mexican food really emerged around this time period in convents. I mean, the best ingredients coming into the country on these Manila galleons. Basically, the church got first dibs on everything. So this is where we start seeing dishes like mole, which is sort of the quintessential Mexican dish, emerged in the convents. So we're going to be making a dish called cajeta that's like a dulce de leche. It's like a caramel, but it's made with goat's milk. And just talking about her story and talking about the evolution and the history of Mexican cuisine, which is one of the topics that I'm most interested in, especially around her time.
Art can often feel very intimidating to people, but eating and drinking is something everyone knows how to do. Does combining the two make art feel more accessible?
I think so. I think 100%. I think that oftentimes people walk into a museum and they're big, you can't touch anything. You don't know where to start, what to look for, how to look, like, should I like this? Should I not? Like, it's just, it can be very intimidating. But when you bring in this aspect, right, of food and drink, which is something that is so familiar, it kind of breaks the ice. And it makes art much more accessible because we really think about these objects that we're looking at. We sort of think about, okay, who was making this? Who was viewing this? And it just becomes much more relatable. You know, these were made by people, for people. So when we put ourselves in the shoes of those people, then it becomes much more real, you know?
Maite Gomez-Rejon is the founder of Art Bites, where she teaches workshops on art, food, and history. She spoke earlier this year with the world's Carol Hills. In Jamaica, the first musicians to play rock steady and ska were no strangers to eating their art, lyrically anyway. How about some classic C-plus and Bami? That would be octopus, stewed or grilled, along with steamed cassava. Jamaican singer-songwriters like Aubrey Adams, she's on the mic right now, turned food into song lyrics. In the early days of ska, the tunes proudly uplifted Jamaican food culture, but the sometimes unusual combinations of local foods they sang about also showed the willingness of Jamaican artists to shake things up stylistically in their music. We leave you on this Thanksgiving Day with a Jamaican instrumental take on food, also from Aubrey Adams along with saxophone legend Rico Rodriguez. This track is called Stew Peas. We call them pinto beans in Jamaica. They go by peas. Stew peas and cornflakes. See if you can work that into your Black Friday breakfast or lunch. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Enjoy the rest of your day. Enjoy the leftovers. And we'll see you right back here tomorrow.